The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
Growing up, I had a sense of disconnection from the world. It made itself known in my life through depression, sadness, dissociation, and fear. As time moved on and I began to live more into my truth, into myself, I reflected back on my past experiences as a child and saw that this pain that I would so often feel truly was the result of a radical disconnect, a schism between me and a way of being in the world that was real, authentic, true. Because of this experience, I have spent the majority of my spiritual journey dedicated to looking into the nature of this disconnect and why it occurs. Through my studies, I found a resounding truth that there is a legacy of American disconnection that lives and breathes in all of our bodies, something that has been taught to us from a very young age. What is it exactly? It wasn't until I read this James Baldwin quote that my beliefs, ideas, and theories began to solidify. James Baldwin says, quote, "I have always been struck in America by an emotional poverty so bottomless and a terror of human life, of human touch so deep that virtually no American appears able to achieve any viable organic connection between his public stance and his private life. This failure of the private life has always had the most devastating effect on American public conduct and black-white relations." End quote. This quote truly helped me understand that the brokenness and pain we are witnessing in our world today directly comes from our lack of a healthy personal and interpersonal connection. This feeling of disconnect I had as a child was the legacy of American disconnection intertwining itself into my private life, debilitating my sense of self, and influencing how I interacted with the world. Baldwin reminds us that to have a nourishing private life, we must be fully in our humanness, letting go of this terror of depth, truth, vulnerability, realness. And if we let go of this terror, then something radical could happen to us and the world. Where would we be if we were more vulnerable, more true to ourselves? Where would we be if we were more in tune with interconnection and the beauty of life? I think that our world would look remarkably different than how it does now. So I began to search for what the building blocks of American disconnection were. What created this insidious thing? What are its beliefs, values, and personality traits that have snuck into my life? I finally landed on several foundational characteristics that are most common in American living, things that have made this disconnection into a powerful puppet master. These are perfection, stagnancy, performance, and fear of conflict. Today, I want to talk specifically about perfectionism, its dangers to our society, and the antidote I use when it appears in my internal world. Perfectionism was the first characteristic that I worked with on my spiritual journey of reconnection, and one of the most powerful forces I faced. I hope that today you may find some relatedness to my experience of it, and in turn find further healing in any disconnect you may feel in your life. So, perfectionism, I'm curious how many people would call themselves a perfectionist or say that perfection has influenced their life in any way? You can raise your hand. That's, yeah, majority of the people. Some of you escaped. Good job. So, if you were to Google perfectionism, you will get many results, books, articles. It is a phenomenon that is widely spoken about in the modern world today, in modern psychology and mindfulness circles. Perfectionism, according to the internet, is when an individual strives to meet impossibly high expectations for themselves, pushing past their limit without rest or healthy self-encouragement of any kind. It is when someone is highly critical of themselves and others to the point of unfairness. Perfectionism causes defensiveness in the face of feedback, personal offensiveness when criticized. There is a fear of failure, fear of mistakes and disapproval, an overemphasis on the I should haves of any situation. Perfection, according to many, is the antithesis to success and a healthy life. After doing my research on the standard understandings of perfectionism, I had no difficulty connecting these characteristics to American life today. When I look at the educational system we are putting our kids through, let alone the one I myself have gone through, I see impossibly high expectations and pressure to be high performing. When I look at the corporate workforce and culture, I see a fast-paced, relentless world where mistakes or rest are not an option. And then, of course, there is the social media phenomenon that has gripped generations of young folks in the world today, who are now constantly peppered with photos and videos of people living their perfect lives. In preparation for this sermon, I was thinking a lot about what perfection means to me. The first image that always comes to my mind is the classic ads from the 50s of housewives with their carefully manicured clothes and hair, cooking food for their working husbands with briefcases and their cute two kids in pigtails and overalls. It's interesting because I was never brought up with these images in my childhood. I've probably only seen them a few times in school, yet it is an image that is seared into my brain. And when I think of the words, a perfect life. And as much as I see myself as radical and progressive, it is also the image I see when I think of the words, a perfect woman. This is the white American dream, an ideal that has been built in the foundation of this country. It is more insidious in our culture than we think, living in our expectations, dreams, and beliefs. There may have been radical cultural transformations since the 50s, but we are still collectively influenced by the hope for American enlightenment, perfection. When I think about what it is like to be a human being, I am reminded of chaos. pure, lively, unrestricted chaos. And this American dream of a perfect family and perfect house is the opposite of chaos. It is control. I think that this is what perfection is, a societal and personal attempt at controlling the pure pandemonium of what it means to be a human being. When we strive for perfection, we are building walls around the rawness of our full selves. This breeds shame, but simultaneously ignores it, making us terrified of our own deepest selves. You see, we are flawed, failures, mistake makers, trippers, and tripping hazards, whirling around in our lives trying to figure out what to do with ourselves, even if we have done it the day before and the day before. Perfection is non-existent, an illusion of control that can crumble at any moment. Death, illness, traffic, a screaming four-year-old, a stubbed toe, all of these are amongst the infinite amount of beautifully chaotic occurrences that crash and burn any thought we may have that we are in control. Human life should be a balance between pattern and chaos, a dance between the two. We should be taught at a young age to surrender to this flow, to yield to the unwieldiness of our spirits and the turbulence of our lives. Instead, the world we live in teaches perfection and control. It sneaks its dogma into parenting and relationships and communities because we have never been taught anything different. Perfection is both a deeply personal trait, one that is unique to each of us and our identities, and yet, oddly enough, a reoccurring blueprint from human to human, particularly in America. So, you are looking at someone who lives and breathes a very strong perfectionist drive. For me, it comes in the form of get better. Get better. These are the words that have echoed in my mind for as long as I can remember. Get better. These are the words that underlie every decision I made and continue to make in pursuit of religious leadership, personal goals, and daily living. Get better. A constant stream of, you need to fix this. You need to stop doing this. You need to get over this. You need to be better. Why? Why do I need to get better? So that I can actually do some good in this world, so I can truly be a good minister and chaplain, so I can be successful and respected and loved. Am I even worthy of love if I don't get better? Perhaps if I build this wall around the things I don't quite like about myself, maybe, just maybe, no one will notice. Maybe I can fool everyone. If I strive to get better, maybe one day I'll become better. I've spent my entire life wanting to be better at things. My biggest drive has always been towards becoming a minister, a servant of God, a teacher, and a healer. Ministry is my passion, my purpose, my truth. I have pursued my spirituality and relationship with the divine wholeheartedly throwing myself into uncomfortable situations of spiritual rigor so that I could be prepared for this work. This drive for perfection in ministry has been both a blessing and a curse. On one hand, it has given me the opportunity to work hard, challenge myself, and pursue something I love with the full force of a fiery comet hurtling through space. But on the other hand, these expectations for myself have removed me from opportunities of vulnerability and authenticity. And it has promoted mentalities of self-hatred, restlessness, and disappointment, rather than self-love, patience, and encouragement. When I am wrapped up in being this image of a perfect minister, then I am in defense mode, trying to prevent people from coming in too close, trying to convince myself that I am the image I want myself to be. There's another aspect of this drive towards perfection that I have found in my life. For a very long time, I tried to be the perfect friend, daughter, and woman. Why? Because I wanted to be loved. And there was a part of me, and there still is a part of me, that believed that if I didn't act, look, and sound a certain way, then I would not be loved. If I pretended like I was fine all the time, and always listened and gave and was sweet and nice, then people would love me. But what kind of love is it that I am receiving if I am approaching others from a place of guarded, performed perfection? Let's take a deep breath together and pause on this thought, that the American ideal of perfection is a currency for love and worthiness, and a guard against the truth and chaos of human living. It is interesting to me because I know that and truly hope that while my situation is unique to me, it also very much is not. I'm sure that all of you sitting here today have had similar feelings of trying to perfect yourself in some way. We live in a society that has a deep, strong current of cultural perfectionism, so it is hard to avoid feeling like we are not constantly failing at something. So what are we to do? Should we fight the perfection, screaming affirmations of worthiness at ourselves and our mirrors every morning? Should we commit to failure, insistent on all anarchy against the perfectionist complex in our society? Should we try to love every single inch of ourselves? I would say all of these could have some usefulness at certain points in our journey with perfection, but I believe that what we need is something more powerful, something that is organic. Because we are not just working against perfection, but its loyal soldiers, shame and fear. This is no walk in the park. I want to make that clear. Perfection is an incredibly difficult, profoundly powerful lived experience that can do far more damage to the well-being of our private lives than we think. And I believe that the answer, the mightiest force that we can utilize, is in forgiveness. I forgive myself for not being perfect. Instead of trying to overcome my fears and insecurities or focus on boosting my self-confidence or trying to love every single aspect of myself, which can be a daunting task, I'm realizing now that I must first try to forgive myself. Because forgiveness is transformation. not fixing or overcoming or defeating. When something transforms, it does not change into something else. It evolves, it coalesces organically into a finer form of its own self. Forgiveness is the transformation of pain and hurt, of high expectations and a constant feeling of failure into a steady bodily knowing of ease and presence. It doesn't mean that the pain goes away and that I am magically fixed, unafraid and confident and perfect. It means that I see these imperfections, these things that feel so heavy in my body, and I choose to let them be as they are without overwhelming me. I choose to move forward and live a life where my fears and insecurities are not made worse by any anger I might feel towards them. To do this is to allow for a softening, a release of tension. We are no longer angry at the imperfections, but rather in presence with them. We do not need to be in love with all of our imperfections. That is never a requirement. But if we seek to witness them, to witness ourselves in fullness and in truth, without illusions of control, then we release the power of perfection and invite in this new energy of transformation. Forgiving gives us the opportunity to see the growth and profound power in the flaws of our beings, the beauty inherent within us. Imperfection can be challenging, transforming a radical energy that moves us to change, grow, and heal. By forgiving ourselves, we are empowering the imperfections to become co-conspirators in the expression of our brightest, fullest selves. So, I live with two dogs, and you're gonna see where this is going in a second, but I'm gonna drink some water. One of them is named Bixby, and she is a purebred border collie. And she's an incredibly special dog. She's full of personality and exuberance and this tender, tender love. And she has taught me something incredibly important about perfection. So sometimes I take Bixby for a walk and I let her off leash because she's very smart. She doesn't go too far from me. And I also let her off leash because she likes to play with sticks. But these are not really sticks, actually. They're branches. She likes branches that are 4-5 times as big as her body. Huge, huge branches. So she's a big dog. She's medium-sized, around 40 pounds. But some of these branches that she tries to pick up are way, way too big for her. I'll look over my shoulder, and there she is, hauling this giant branch, trying to bring it back with her to the house. And she's like switching angles and trying to gnaw off little bits and dragging it along and just really trying to accommodate her goal and trying so hard. And she doesn't give up. And, you know, I don't speak dog, but it's clear to me that Bixby does not have a single drop of perfectionism in her body. She's not thinking to herself, I wish I was stronger. Why are we even doing this? You should be able to drag this branch back to the house. It's kind of unacceptable that you're not doing that right now. I guarantee that if she was saying these things in that gorgeous little head of hers, this dog would not be going at this branch like it's the, you know, end of the world. You know, she would be transfixed by by her own self-regrets and disappointments, she would just be staring at the branch. But eventually, you know, Bixby can't actually drag this giant branch. And when it becomes clear that that's not going to happen, she abandons the branch with the same ease that she approached it. She lets it go. And she doesn't walk the rest of the way home with her head hung low in shame and disappointment in herself. She just moves on to the next branch, one that is a little smaller that she can bring home with her. I know that we're not all dogs, but there's something to learn from Bixby. Whenever I see her do this, I deeply feel like I am in the presence of a holy lesson. In forgiving ourselves, we are actively at peace with our limitations. Would we prefer to drag a 10-foot branch for 2 miles? Absolutely, I would love to do that. But sometimes that simply cannot happen. Sometimes we have to find a 6-foot branch. If we can forgive ourselves and our mistakes, limitations, flaws, then we can pivot, learn our lesson, and move forward without holding on to shame and anger. Then we can cultivate a sense of trust in our true natures. So how can perfectionism and forgiving ourselves be applied to the external world beyond our private lives? By seeing and forgiving the imperfections in ourselves, we are learning to see and forgive the imperfections that exist within the shared fabric of humanity, that which is in each human. To be actively forgiving with others is to uphold the belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. This does not mean that we take a step back and let it go or ignore the injustices of others. Nor does it mean that we are in love with everyone. It means that we acknowledge the existence of something and choose to not allow it to affect our lives in a negative way. It means that we choose to act and live and transform despite the burdens and hardships of this world. If we are capable of forgiving, inclusive of all the ridiculousness that is our humanhood, then we have achieved a kind of love that burns away fear and collapses walls and fights for goodness and righteousness. A kind of love that births a private life rich in meaning. I want to end on this thought of disconnection and the words of James Baldwin. He says that our lack of a healthy private life has created a terror of human living that affects how we treat others. So then I wonder what impact could the transformation of perfection within ourselves have on the culture we live in? How could finding forgiveness be a powerful tool against disconnect? Would we see a radical change in our politics, in the social world we live in? Would James Baldwin look at the world and see something different if we learned radical forgiveness? I truly think so. So at this moment, I call upon your beautiful, full selves. I invite in the monsters and the shames and the mistakes of past, present, and future. I welcome them with loving arms because they are you, an essential aspect of you, and they must be forgiven. Let us reclaim the richness of our private lives by embracing ourselves in our wholeness, by forgiving ourselves and saying to the world, I may be flawed, but I am still powerful. I am still me. And I will love more fiercely than ever before. Amen.
Have you ever watched a TV show or a movie with someone, and then after it's over, they just want to talk about it, wanting to connect with each other, relate over a shared piece of culture? How obnoxious is that, am I right? I mean, sure, it's easy when you saw something perfect, but we can't always watch Ted Lasso or Avatar The Last Airbender. And then they really enjoy it, and they ask, oh, how did you like it?
Well, actually, I thought that Dune was kind of slow, and splitting it into two parts was gonna ruin the juxtaposition at the center of the story. Or, yeah, the action in Invincible was fun, but geez, I could have written better dialogue. How do you deal with it when something is imperfect? You either go with shallow platitudes, or you criticize and you yuck somebody's yum. There's no winning. And when the thing that's imperfect is that a friend has bad taste in movies, surely it's not me, then that's not the end of the world. We can just live and let live, agree to disagree, move on. But what about when it's bigger? When someone is mishandling an important responsibility? Or what about when the person who's imperfect is me? When I was in college, I started a nonprofit to help computer science students use their skills for social change. We would put on events and help connect them to other nonprofits. It was a great mission. We had some real impact. It was a good experience for me. The first time that I had really started something on my own, and it gave me a chance to experiment and to try new things, figure out what would work best. But I was never really good at sharing the responsibility. Sure, we had a team, I delegated some things, but the core stuff, the important stuff, I had plenty of good excuses. I was willing to put in the work, I didn't want to force it on anybody else, I had the most experience, but a lot of it was also that I knew I would do a good job, and I didn't trust that other folks would come back with something good enough, something perfect. And the result was that it wasn't sustainable. I got burned out, I stopped enjoying it, I didn't put in the work necessary to make it grow as much as it could have, and when I eventually did hand things off to somebody else, I didn't do a very good job. The organization is still around, still doing some good work, but when I wasn't willing to trust others and forgive them if they made some mistakes, I held everything back. In my job now, I'm a manager, and I do a little bit better, more by necessity than anything else. It's hard to be a control freak about everybody's work and micromanage everything when there just aren't enough hours in the day. And that means being willing to sit down with someone and help when they need help, and sit back when they don't. Coach somebody, tell them that it's okay if they make mistakes, or if they're taking on more than they can handle, that we're a team and we can help carry the load. And sometimes I still do make mistakes, but one of the benefits of making those mistakes, one of the benefits of failing to delegate or yucking somebody's yum when I criticize too harshly, is that if you're mentoring someone and they have those same challenges, at least you have some good stories to tell.